You need to unmute yourself, Debbie.
There we go. Billy, would you put up the last slide, the Bill W's intro slide, please? Thank you. Okay, so welcome back, everybody. Again, if we'll have a little bit of Q&A before the next break. Hope you all got back okay from your break. So in continuing with definitions of sober, so one of the definitions, and I got a really big kick out of this, was, go to the next slide, Billy. It said another definition of sobriety is subdued in tone as color, not colorful or showy as clothes. Well, I had to laugh because my closet would not be considered sober, okay? I love flashy, sparkly, blingy, light 'em up, you know, feathers. You got it, girl. I love that. And like, for example, I have a pretty sequiny top, red top on. I have a glitzy necklace on, glitzy bracelets and rings and shoes. And it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'll wear this out to go, maybe I'll go not grocery shopping today, but I would wear this anywhere. Yesterday, I went to the doctor's. I had a black sparkly top with black rhinestone dangly Art Deco style earrings, and I'm snapping away. I mean, I am comfortable with who I am, but not everybody really knows how to get there. So I'm going to share you the journey with how I got there. So the next slide, please. As I've learned and taken the steps and lived in these three legacies, emotional sobriety for me encourages, promotes, and supports authenticity. Now, I didn't get that or understand that for a long time. We're just going to leave that up there. I specifically did that in a red background because red is my favorite color. And so this is part of my authenticity. So I've got a daily reader that I enjoy very much. It's not produced by AA or Al-Anon or Grapevine, but it's all about moving women toward authenticity. And I just love the simple approach to it. And I look back on how I become comfortable with myself and really kind of the impact I've seen it have on people. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of women who said, well, you know, I see you always wear lipstick, so I started wearing lipstick, or coming to a Zoom meeting instead of in their flannel pajamas and their hair, you know, all, you know, that they put their makeup on, they fixed their hair, they put a blouse on. You know, they came to the room, the Zoom room, just like you would at a real in-person room. And so, you know, and I'm not putting that on anybody. They're just kind of moved or inspired to do that too. And to think that by their telling me, because I did that, they feel comfortable wearing a sparkly top. Maybe not this sparkly, but something with a little rhinestone-y in it or a pretty pin. How that made them feel like they had permission to do that, even though it wasn't a special night out on the town, that they could do it just because they liked to do it. It made them feel good. That's what authenticity is. I remember reading many years ago an interview with like one of the high-end fashion designers. And they said, define the difference between style and fashion. And he said, well, fashion is always going to be what's at the moment, the color, the shape, the size, the design. But style, the woman creates. Style is you. And so I know that there are clothing today I would not wear because it might be in and the style and the fashion, but it's not complimentary to me. we find the colors and the styles that make us feel good. I know the colors that absolutely look terrible on me and the ones that I love. Bright, vibrant, those colors look best on me. And so, you know, how I got there, learning how to be good enough with what I am. I'm good with myself. I like myself. You know, there's that old phrase, do you like what's looking back at you at the mirror? If not, what can you do about it? What could you do differently? Helping to be the best me I am, and that where I am is absolutely fine, as long as I'm not doing it at someone else's expense, for example. Now, let me just say one thing. When I introduced myself, I identified as being 44 years plus sober. I did not say, I'm going to be 45 in February. And it goes back to being what you are, where you are. I've had so much of I'm gonna's. And the reason I gonna you is I want to look better in your eyes, I think, than I am. If I'm going to go, I'm going to do, I'm going to, that might be, maybe I will. But what it does is it discounts where I am. So like when I ask somebody, so how long are you sober? Well, I'm going to be 23 in March. I said, so you're 22. The question was, how long are you sober? Not how long will you be at your next birthday? And so learning to listen is also a huge thing. Now, let me take you back to a girl's school story that I remember the little school uniform. I was at the Catholic school on the brick steps. I'm in first grade and I'm talking to a second grader. And she says to me, so what grade are you in? And my reply was, I'll be in second grade next year. Because saying I'm in first grade wasn't cool enough, wasn't big enough. I wasn't, in my thinking, I wanted to be bigger and more important in your eyes. Being where and what I was, I'm in first grade, wasn't good enough. And it's taken a long time to be where I am is just right. It's absolutely fine in my life. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have dreams and I want to pursue something. I want to do this. I want to do that. No. But when you ask me the question, let me answer it accurately, authentically, not I'm going to be so I can look bigger in your eyes. Now, how did I, you know, Yvonne described our home. I love the Art Deco style. Very few people would think about tricking out an entire guest room with the investment we made in this in Wizard of Oz. Totally good. In our home, though, it was natural. This didn't seem anything odd. Surprising, fun, yeah. But that's my personality. My husband, he's moving in that direction, and he loved every bit of it. But the point of it was, is your home reflects your personality. After I took those steps and really got to, and that experience will come up again in a few other sections. I was 7 years sober. I'm talking to a guy friend of mine. Now, I really had little confidence in my taste. I was raised in the Midwest. Everything's polyester. There's very little color there, at least in our home. There's very little sophistication. Parents, one left eighth grade, one left high school, no college. So there was no worldly things. Except for my dad going into the army, they've never left the country. I mean, very small environment because they came from small environments. So when I took that inventory, part of it was, now I'm you know, 6+ years sober when I'm doing this at the time. And the mother and father were on the resentment list. Now, even though I had made amends to them from the original, they're on the resentment list because I think they should have been more. I think they should have been better, more influential in town, more, you know, I discredited what skills and talents they had. And that I should have known all these designers and been to Europe and the art museums and blah, 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 blah. Now, I didn't think that when I got sober. I had no relation to that. But now here I am 6+ years sober, and I'm thinking, they should have done this. They should have done that. They didn't give me any good counsel on good taste. And so I'm very feeling insecure. Now, let me just finish that four-step story in the sense so that I didn't leave that hanging. Is that I came to realize in the fourth column, which is the game changer, the growing up column, the emotional sobriety column, what was my fault? Where am I to blame? What were my mistakes? Where was I wrong? It's never about what's my part. It's about those other four things. I began to realize you cannot teach something you don't know. Just like in the vision for you often read at meetings, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. You cannot teach something you don't know. They did not know those things. They were not important to them. Why all of a sudden it seemingly was important to me, I don't know. But here was the deal. Deb, if you think that is important for you to know or experience, stop whining. Stop blaming. Do something about it. Go educate yourself. Go save your money and go to those places. Stop blaming them for what you think they should have been. Wow. Huge shift from blaming to take responsibility. My sponsor, Millie, who passed away in January 31st of this year, she and I were together 33 years. She said, if you take the me out of blame, you get blah, blah, blah. Yep, that's right. There's a bunch of blah, blah, blah. So here I am now, 7 years sober. I've taken that inventory. I'm starting my growing up process, but I'm still very insecure about my choices. Will people approve? I'm not looking to be in some fashion magazine of Home and Garden or whatever. But will they think, oh, she sure got good taste? I mean, who am I doing this for? So anyway, my guy friend is there. And I said, now, I'm going to talk about baskets and pillows. And this is not, if you love 100 pillows on your bed, I love it. If you like baskets everywhere in your home, fantastic. It's just not my style. And so I said to him, though, so Barb, she's got a lot of baskets around her house with stuff in them. And I'm going to put some, I'm moving into a fairly new apartment, and I'm going to put a bunch of baskets around. And Joni, she's got pillows around. And so I'm going to get a bunch of pillows and put those, because you see, I looked at them as having good taste, and therefore I'm going to imitate them. Well, he just said simply, well, what do you like? Oh, good question. What do I like? I know I don't like pillows in baskets, but I want you, whoever you are, to think I have good taste. So if I do what they do, if I copy them, then you'll think that. Well, that isn't very authentic, is it? So I thought, okay, what do I like? And it wasn't like that moment I came up with an answer. But I started thinking, well, I like color. I, as Yvonne mentioned earlier, I love the movies. Okay, so I got permission to paint the walls, and I painted a bright yellow. I painted a pretty blue, a bright blue, not a dark. I painted color in the house. I had movie posters and movie star pictures, especially the old ones. I love the old ones, all over the place. I had books all about the movies or the history or this or that. When I came home, I was home. I felt great. I loved being in the area that the warmth and passions that I have around me. And when people would come over, because it wasn't your typical situation, it was like, again, it opened up that difference. And when I would go to other people's houses, instead of, oh, that's stupid, I can't, oh my god, it gave me that appreciation. This is them. Let me see the little, maybe it's knickknacks or collections they have, or that they love 100 pillows on the bed. They don't mind taking 10 minutes to put them off and put them back on. They're great. I love it. It's amazing. And so it took me out of my own self-judgment to appreciation. And then when I went to your place, to honor you. And once again, it wasn't comparing. I might get ideas from you. Oh, I really like how they did that. Ah, that's a cool thing. And to appreciation, that to me is emotional sobriety. That's growing up. That is growing up and having, acting like an adult, responding like an adult, and responding with kindness and care. Now, let me tell you about my clothing. So when I didn't have any guidance on good style or taste. When you're kids and you're kind of dressing how everybody else dresses, you want to be a part of the same crowd. And I never really gave it a thought. I wore makeup. Of course, I wore lots of makeup. Many of us did when we were in teenagers, and the more the better, right? You know, whether it's the raccoon eye time or the whatever it was, and your hair and all that kind of styles. But I never felt that confident with that. So once again, if that's important to you, then have someone show you. Learn about it. Right now we got about, you know, I don't even know if God knows how many tutorials there are on whatever topic you're interested, flower decorating or makeup or, making a sachet. You know, there's everybody's got an idea. So I move from Atlanta to Southern California. Oh, man, what a culture shock for me. I've gone from small towns in South and North Dakota to Minneapolis. Well, that was the first one. Then Atlanta was a little bigger. You moved to Southern California. You got Hollywood influence all over the place. I had never heard of fake boobs. You know, I had never heard of boob jobs and nose jobs and all that kind of jobs. Okay. Totally foreign. And the designer names that people were blah, 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 blah. I'd never heard. I felt like, oh my God, I got a lot of catching up to do of education. I got to be able to recognize things right away. Like that's going to, again, improve who I am as a person. Elevate me in your eyes because I can spot, oh, that those shoes are by so-and-so, or there's that handbag is so-and-so's. And so my first couple of years, I moved to Southern California because I'd gotten married. And there was a couple that were very, 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 very good friends. So there was the four of us that really went in a pack. We did a lot of things together those first few years. And she seemed to have the savvy for what was in appropriate designer, the color, the style. And so I felt, well, she can be my kind of unofficial mentor. So kind of what she's doing, I will copy. Now, nobody but me knew this. Not one person ever gave me the, tisk, you know, oh, you're just not suitable enough. You're not good enough. That is so last week. Oh my God, right? Nobody did that to me but me. Because always I was comparing. Always I was comparing. She would come in with a pair of shoes, and I might have the very same designer shoes, but hers were the cool ones. Mine were the kind of wannabes, or not quite the same level. And I found this terrible inferiority of me. And again, I want to stress, not one person said a word, pointed and laughed, put anything on me. I was doing this. And after about a year and a half, I don't remember that anything particular happened. Like a lot of things, when we have a shift or we make a decision about something, I don't know where it came from, but I'm grateful it did. Because I woke up and I just had this feeling, you know what? I don't care anymore. What color is the year, color is this year? Short or long skirts? Jackets or no jackets? Whatever it is, I don't care anymore. What I'm going to care about is, do I enjoy this? Is this complimentary to me? Is this fit right? Do I feel me? You can pick up any magazine, and frankly, I would not be caught literally dead in some of those things. I'd have no idea who buys that stuff. It doesn't look comfortable. It whatever the reason is, and I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. What I look for in the magazines is their creativity with color. That's what I look at them for. Oh, I love how they put those two together. I never would have thought to do that. So over the years, I become very, very comfortable and have a lot of fun with my wardrobe. Now, I've been up here 20 years, at least 10 before that, probably pretty much since I moved to Southern California, about 34 years, I think it is now, I've had a separate bedroom converted into a closet. I like to be able to see everything, and I love to put at least three colors together. So I might pick a blouse with a bunch of colors, and then the skirt or pants and the jewelry complement it and the shoes. Or I'll pick a purse and put those colors together, because I never would have put those colors together, but wow, they look great. And so I'll do that. I have a lot of fun since the pandemic started. So Yvonne mentioned that we had moved out. So when we moved out, I took a third with me because it was only going to be for a short while, which turned out to be 16 and a half months. I left a bunch here, and then there was some in storage. And so when we reunited everything, I was so busy with other things, I did not have time to like review and go through stuff. So now the pandemic hits. You're not going anywhere. So a lot of people took those first 2 weeks to clean out their closet. I'm still cleaning it out, but for a different reason. Instead of doing it all at once, I decided that I would do it one item at a time, meaning whether it was a blouse or a dress or a skirt or something. I would do it one at a time, and that way I would, I really, you know what, this just doesn't do it for me. So I might wear it one time, launder it, and then donate it. And that is how I've gone through my closet. But once I've worn it, it goes to the back of the line. Because otherwise you wear your favorites or whatever. And if there's a reason I'm not wearing something and have it for a year or more, there's a reason. It's a hassle. You got to pull it down. You got to pull it up. You got to do gift it. Let it go. Because I can't add more to something already full. And that is how I am going through that stuff and finding what no longer suits me, what no longer is appropriate. I remember I was probably about 45, 47 years old, and I went to a friend's cookie party at Christmas. And there was one woman there who was very, very beautiful. She'd been in the cosmetic industry forever. She knew all the high to low end products, all the tricks of the trade. And I remember her saying that, you know, women over 50 shouldn't wear skirts above the knee. And I thought, oh, well, I'm about 45 or 47, whatever it was. I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to be minus a lot of skirts if that's such, nah. About 55, I started agreeing with her. Let me tell you, things shifted to the south. And a little bit more than I wanted. And I started agreeing with her. So a lot of those shorter skirts above the knee don't look so hot anymore. So, you know, again, what is more, if I'm feeling uncomfortable in my outfit, that's on me. Let it go. Someone else, one of the women in the recovery homes can use a nice skirt suit outfit for job interviews or going to someplace nice, or maybe they're going to a wedding or a funeral or someplace, you know, they will use this. So I've learned to come to really enjoy having fun through being creative, not because I've come up with it, but somebody else has come up with this color pattern. I love that. And to really, if I feel good in it, I get to keep it. If not, we lovingly pass it on. But it took me a long time. Like I say, I was probably about 12 years sober at the time when I made that move and shift. You know, when we got married, Kent and I got married, it was April 14th of 2001. I had a red wedding gown. It was one of those big babies, red with stars, hot glued all on the gown that Kent did himself. We did what we wanted to do, not what society says you should. We wrote our own vows, not what you're supposed to write and read. I mean, it's really been do what speaks to you. What touches your spirit? You love all black? Go for it, girl. You love all white, you love all orange, you love something, you love wearing your jeans. Hey, you know, I just want, one of the things that I enjoy doing though, is when I leave the house, I'm in full makeup and hair is done. Because I never know who I'm going to meet. I want to be fully presentable and wear something appropriate and nice out there. Because so many people dress down. I just want to be comfortable. And I go to the meetings. They go to the meetings like that too. Well, gee, I always think to myself, I want to look like I'm somebody who's 44 years sober, not 44 days sober. You know, I want to look like my life has changed. I'm not my story. So find your authenticity. What speaks to you? This is a part of emotional sobriety and feeling that confidence in that kind of thing. Okay. So next slide, please. Emotional sobriety and amends. Recently in within the last few months, Alcoholics Anonymous, page 1112, this is in Bill's story. He says, now Ebby has come to call on him, carry the message of sobriety if he cared to have it. You know, but he's a little skeptical, but he's like, wow, I cannot deny Ebby is different. And he says, I saw that my friend was much more than in the highlight and bolding as mine, because these are the words that really popped off the page. Inwardly reorganized. And that's what kept sticking in my mind. Inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil. That's what the steps have done. They've inwardly reorganized me. Each of the steps have done that. And I have been on a new and different footing for a long time, and my roots have grasped that new soil. The reason I entitled this and amends, what emotional sobriety and amends looks like, is one amends that I wanted to share with you. Because I learned more from this amend than any that I have before. So, when I was about 12 years old, it was a very big year for me. 1970, I'm 63 now, so you don't have to count on your fingers. When I was 12 years old, I had my first drink in that April. My parents would separate that summer. I would turn 13 in September, and my parents would divorce, and my father would remarry a woman in December of that year. So it was a very big changing year, a lot moving and so forth like that. And while I was the golden goose pre-marriage, I was the no longer needed one post-marriage. She had three kids. There was me. This was not the Brady Bunch. Let me just mention that. It did not blend well. Whenever one of them would get in trouble 3-1, I would have to be in trouble for something. When I would get good grades, when I was, the alcoholism had gone too far, I'd get good grades and be on the honor roll and be, well, aren't you special? Aren't you so smart? Because her kids never made that. So it was more and more my alcoholism plus this disconnect in this family pulled me back further and further into isolation. We would move then when I was about 15, close to 16, I guess, to North Dakota for my dad's work. And then it would be just her younger son and myself. We were always starting over, always making the new pact. But my alcoholism, I'm going to take responsibility. Number one, you got puberty going on. You got the teenager from hell years, and you got alcoholism. I mean, this was not an easy combo like for any parent to deal with. So we moved to North Dakota, and my alcoholism like went shoo through the roof, rocketed out of control. And at 17 and a half, I'm committed to this place. While there, we were supposed to take the first five steps. Well, you know, I've been dry for a few weeks, and I'm supposed to do an inventory, and it was stupid. I don't even know half of what to say. I don't know what to do. Really goofy. I understand it, but it was pointless. In making the amends, they wanted me to call her up, call her mom, and make some kind of apology. There was about as much value, feeling, meaning to that action as me, you know, petting a rock, right? Zero. All right, but I did it. All right, so now we get into real recovery months later. I get a real sober date. I have this 6.9-year crash and meltdown. And on the inventory, she is the number one. Now, prior to this, there had been a lot of close moments for me to make a real amend, because I knew that was a bunch of crap. I'd get 90% to forgiveness, but I couldn't cross the line of that 10 for some reason. Just so close. Because I knew in step 8, before I moved to 9, I better be on 100% forgiveness, because it's never about what they did. It's about taking responsibility for what I did. As I said earlier, my harms, my wrongs, my mistakes, my faults. I went to a conference. I remember very, very clearly. In October of that year, and before I went into the Saturday night meeting, if you'd have said to me, say, yeah, Deb, when are you going to make amends to your stepmother? Soon. It's soon. She's on the list. And now the speaker that night was a guy named Paul M. from Chicago. He died with 60 many years of sobriety. I mean, like 65, 7, I don't remember the amount. But he was a very, very popular speaker. This is 85, I think. Very popular speaker. It's 1985. He had just come, I was in Georgia, so he had just come up from Florida to on his way home to speak at our conference. And he had just been in Florida with 30 years of sobriety, making amends to his father. So anytime you've done something you finally should be doing, you know what kind of a bandwagon on. By God, if you got amends to make them while they're still alive and they're before they die, and you say you wish you would have, he says. Oh, bam. Hit me big. So, because I know many of us might have arrived here with the person already having have died that we know we owe amends to. I did not have any of those people. So I'm thinking, oh, upon exiting that conference night, that's not meeting, if you'd have said to me, so Deb, when are you going to make those amends? Now's the time. I mean, it was a complete shift for me regarding that amends. Now, this is 1985. We don't have cell phones. We don't have internet. Can't really find people like we can today. She was very, very private, and all I had was a post office box, and I don't even know if that's still her last name or not. She's not listed in the phone book. So I write a letter of amends. Now, I will be the first to tell you it was probably a crappy letter of amends. It probably wasn't very good. And I probably said something like, I learned some things and I don't hate you anymore and I forgive you for this or that. It was probably a terrible, terrible letter. I'm going to say that right out front. I did not review it with the sponsor. And like I said, I have learned so many to-dos and not to-dos regarding this amends. This is why it's such a key turning point for me in emotional sobriety. So I send off this letter to the post office box, and about a month later, I get a phone call from this woman. The moment I heard her voice, because there's no screen caller ID, I thought, oh, my gut didn't go for the first time in years. I thought, dang it, this amends thing works, right? She said, I got your letter, but I really don't know what you're talking about. you say you're making amends, and I don't even know what these things are, but what I do remember is, I mean, she had a machine gun loaded with stuff she remembered, let me tell you. I'm like, are you sure that was me, right? Oh my God. Swear on my big book, I do not remember doing or saying the things she said I did. But what I learned from that, and I will share another amends with you, in her heart, I did. I did those things. I had learned a little something, and I didn't know to do it then. But in making amends, there's a whole nother process. We don't really seem to tap into with our literature. But experience has shown this to be helpful. Now I'm going to tell you what I did. What I recall doing was saying, I'm sorry for those things that I'm attributed to. And I really didn't know what else to say. Today I know to add, is there anything I can do to make that right? By making a direct amends today is making those amends and adding, and any other harms I may have caused you, I'm not aware of. Next is there anything you would like to share with me? And if they do, it's important that I listen without defense. Well, you know, if you hadn't have done, I wouldn't have done that. No. No, you don't get to do that. You get a one-time, they get a one-time opportunity, and you must listen without defense or justification and regret that you caused them that harm. And then, is there anything I can do to make this right? And then pay attention to what they say. Because my opportunity to be a different person in their eyes and right my wrongs, even if I don't remember them, is still my responsibility about growing up and being emotionally sober. Not letting this become my own personal whooping, oh, you made all these mistakes. No, but to grow up. Take responsibility. How many harms have I caused I don't even know about? Now I know some allegedly applied to me. Okay, so the phone call ends. 2 years later, I'm on a trip. Over the weekend, I come back. There's a message. Message machines have come in now. I have a message machine with her voice on it. We were going through Atlanta over the weekend and thought we'd give you a call. We'll call you next weekend. Well, there's no way for me to call her. There's no phone number left, no communication. She probably called from a payphone. Again, there aren't cell phones at this time. I don't know how to tell her. I'm going to be gone next weekend again. So naturally, when I call, there is a come home the second weekend. There is a phone call message. And that is the last I hear from her at all. Okay, now let's go. I'm now 15 years sober. So it's now 8 years from this amends time, 6 years or 5 years, I guess, or 7 years from when she called me. I'm actually in North Dakota where she lives. Again, all I have is a post office box, and I have had no communication with her other than that, those years before. And I learned that she has colon cancer and she probably won't live till Thanksgiving. And I take that information and there's nothing for me to do about it. I'm not going to make this emergency save the day with the white cape on and, oh, our long lost path that we could have had. No, I don't feel that way about her. I'm sorry she's having, you know, I know colon cancer is very painful. I know her family and loved ones are around her. I don't need to bring my type, my person, my history of her in there. We haven't had communication in years. I go on to talk at the conference I was going to talk at, and then I spend some time with another relative up there, and I get the call, she's died. So I get a call from her half-brother, who I knew was in the program. I had actually been in some meetings with him together. And he said, I'm sure you know she died. Yeah. And he said, you know, she was sober for 10 years. I said, what? Well, what was her sobriety day? Who was her sponsor? Did she go, was her home group? And I got all these questions. Well, we don't really know. You know, colon cancer is very painful. She was on a lot of medication at the end. She didn't even tell us till she was 5 years sober, and then she kept it very under key. So I'm like, 10 years of, huh. I go back to that phone calls. She had been sober when she called me. Huh. Wonder why she didn't make amends to me. Huh. Then the second thought came through. It never was about her making amends to me. It never was. Even though my amends were crappy, I'd moved from that place into a place of just kind of comfortable indifference. Nothing they were going to do or say was going to affect my emotional barometer. Let me tell you, that felt really good. Not that I didn't have any feeling either way, but it didn't affect my emotional barometer. And when I realized, it never was about her making amends to me. It was about me making amends to her, poorly as they were. That's what was going to count. Let me tell you another amends that was very interesting to me. So I had a gal call me. I used to sponsor this gal. She moved on in sponsorship. She came back. This is one of the reasons why I've chosen not to sponsor people twice, because they always leave again anyway. But that's my experience and my choice to call. I don't care. My sponsees can sponsor the same person 500 times if they want. That's their business. Mine is, it's hard to have a fresh relationship with someone you're familiar with. So she comes back, and again, she moves on again. Now, one of the things that if I get an opportunity that I will say to the person is there anything that I have done or said that, you know, drew, put you to make that decision? Because if there is, I mean, I really do want to know. Now, if you ask that question, you better be able to listen without debate, okay? You better be able to listen and not argue their point. So I said, is there anything that I had done or said? And she said, no. No. Well, you can't say, I think you're lying. Tell me what it is. So, okay. So now about 7 or 8 years into her sobriety, and I would call her on her AA birthday. We still, I felt, had a very sweet relationship. I had known her since she was 7 days sober. She had a very special place in my heart, and I loved how she had grown over the years. And she called me up one day and she said, we were chitty chatting. And she said, you know, the real reason for my call is, you know, how you would ask me if there was any reason, anything you had done that I, why I moved on in sponsorship. And I've told you no, but actually there is. And I've been thinking a lot about it. I said, oh gosh. Okay, please share that with me if you will. I was not aware, so I would love to hear that. She said, well, remember when I told you I'd been to the doctor and I had this particular condition? I said, yeah, I do. And you told me not to take the medication, and that you gave me a hologram to put in my hand and sleep with that for 3 nights, and that would take care of it. And then we had our traditions meeting. You said in tradition 10 we were on that we don't play doctor, and that, but you were doing that. And so I really, that's what I got uncomfortable with and knew it was time for me to move on. Now, my jaw is dropped, okay? I'm listening to this again. Are you imagining this? Did you dream this? We knew there'd been a little bit of confusion mentally for a while. And I'm like running through my head. First of all, I would never tell anyone not to take medication. This is certainly not my place to do. I would encourage you, yes, work with your doctor. Yes, take it responsibly. Yes, have a pad and paper next to it so you remember. But I'm never going to tell somebody not to do something they have collaborated with a doctor on. You can't put a hologram in somebody's hand. It's illusionary. They're not physical. And the right part would have been tradition 10, we don't play doctor. So I'm listening to this. My first instinct, of course, is to, you must be out of your mind. What are you talking about? I can't believe this. This is goofy stuff. But God stepped in. Emotional sobriety stepped in. Growing up in adulthood stepped in. And I said, I must say, I don't recall doing or saying any of those things. But if I did, I truly regret that I put you in a place that made you feel so uncomfortable. You needed to move on in sponsorship. Is there anything I can do to make that right? And then there's this pregnant pause, and I thought, oh, crap, what'd I do? She said, you just did. Okay. Now, it was the strangest amends, but I knew, just like the stepmother, in her mind and in her heart, she had me written down for those things having done or said that. In her heart. No amount of debate, no I didn't, was going to change that. It probably would have made it even more so. It felt weird taking responsibility for something I know I didn't do or say. But on the other hand, I knew by saying what I shared with you, I said, was going to give her peace or relief or whatever was way more important than me defending I didn't do those things or saying any to that likeness. So that truly is some of those areas where emotional sobriety growing up can come into play and to, again, make me stand a little taller, a little higher, a little bit more comfortable in who I am. Did that cost me anything? No. But it sure did help somebody else. Okay, let's take a little stretch break, a little beverage break if you like. Let's see, it's 2:59. Let's just take a 6-minute break. Let's come back at 3:05 Pacific time. Is that okay with Yvonne? Okay, sounds good. Oh, I didn't ask for any questions. We'll take your questions when we come back from break, okay? All right, if you have any. Okay, thank you.